said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. I mean, this one is thinking to us, this pot. They made that decision to pull, and then we watched them collapse.
They ignored it because they wanted it to happen.
Every one starts with a false flag operation.
We have nothing with the outcast and the unfit. Let them die in their misery, for they feel not. Compassion is the vice of kings. Stamp down the wretched and the weak. This is the law of the strong. This is our law and the joy of the world. Aleister Crowley, The Book of the Law. Hello, and welcome to Historica Esoterica. I am your host and master magician, Matt K. Ultra, joined by my studious acolyte.
Hello, it is I, young Roswell. You can't see, but I just bowed at the webcam for Matt.
I thought it was funny.
Thank you.
We've got a fun one today.
Yeah, spooky.
We're discussing Aleister Crowley.
Crowley, as we call him.
Two things I want to get out of the way right off the top. One, we're going to be pronouncing it Crowley and not Crowley. I've seen it done both ways, and I think Crowley sounds better.
It does.
And two, this guy loved sex. There's a lot of it. I'm going to try my best not to go into too much detail, but regardless, if you're a kid and listening to this, don't. What are you doing? Do something better with your life. But also, you know, maybe skip this episode in particular.
Yeah. We don't want this to have some sort of weird effect on you in the future.
And believe me, it will.
It will. And if you're an adult who's also freaked out by sex,
it still probably will. But, you know, this is your choice to make now.
Yeah. I have to say, personally, when I was reading initially through his Wikipedia page to familiarize myself with him, there was a lot of me going, ew. So...
Yeah, no, that's the appropriate reaction. That's good.
Yeah.
Aleister Crowley, what we're going to do is, initially, I was planning to just sort of do a biography of him, and then as we went, sort of discuss his biggest works. And then I started reading his biggest works along with a biography of him while doing internet research, and sort of drove myself a little crazy. So instead, we're going to just really do a biography and then hit on some of the biggest ideas and books he did.
Yeah.
And maybe we think we might revisit our boy in the future to sort of do more deep dive into his philosophies and rituals.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question about
Crowley? Please,
When and where did you first hear about Aleister Crowley?
I don't remember exactly when I first heard about him. I know I really developed an interest in him my freshman year of college. One of my friends who was also pretty interested in, you know, conspiracy and the occult, he had a much more knowledge about it than I did, and frankly, probably still does. He might be listening, so text me when you hear this. So that's when I first really started getting into him and looking into his stuff. What about you?
I was friends with a lot of like goth and emo kids growing up. And I remember like in middle school or high school, like he was like mentioned by some of like my spookier friends as like, yeah, man, he's so cool. And like, so in my mind, I was like imagining like this sick magician, like, you know, being snide to Christians and like being, you know, total. And he is all of those things, but he's not as cool as like you'd think he is when you're like a edgy, you know, freshman, and you're like, yeah, this will show my mom trying to get me to go to church, you know.
Yeah, that's the arc I have found of most people who learn about Crowley. It's like, oh, this guy's super cool, and then you like after a year or two, you go like, oh wait, but he was doing these things to like real people. He just like ruined these guys' lives, and then you you sort of like him slightly less.
Yeah, he sucks in my opinion. Like, yeah. There are some moments where you're like, okay, he's a little cool. But then there's a lot of moments where you're just like, ugh.
Yeah, he does have his funny moments. He also, I will say, you know, when we get into Thelema and our discussion of it, I think that there are some valuable things there. I just think that it's, unfortunately, buried in evil. So it's, yeah, you know, a little hard to actually extract value out of it, even though it is fun to pretend that you stan Aleister Crowley.
Yeah.
When you're like talking about him, you know, I'm guilty of it. I know we've most of us have it. Been guilty. We've all done it once or twice.
Well, not me. I actually never stan him.
Oh, hey, you know, we can't all be perfect.
yeah, it was one of those things where it's like the cool older kid goth friends would like talk about this spooky magician, and I'll, like, I thought it was interesting, but I was too scared to actually look him up. I don't know if I thought like a monster was going to come out of the Wikipedia page and get me, but
well,
it might. It just might. Lamb, if you're listening.
Oh, you're we'll get into Lamb.
We'll get into Lamb.
All right, so yeah, let's just start with a little biography. Yeah. I'm taking the lead on this one, but Roswell, of course, just jump in, cut me off whenever.
Sure.
He was born Edward Crowley on October 12th, 1875 in England to a wealthy family of fundamentalist Christians. They were fairly conservative. Which,
do you know what group his father was associated with? Did you do any looking into them?
Hang on, I did. Let me...
Because I did as well.
Yeah, what have you got about
anytime them? Fundamentalist Christian comes up, my ears perk up. But they were called the Exclusive Brethren, which is...
Oh, yes, I do remember.
Speaking
this.
Of scary Christian names, like, come on, guys. Spooky. But, you know, like, in terms of belief, kind of your run-of-the-mill Protestant church, especially of the time. However, it's been criticized... I should say accused of using cult tactics on its members, such as like shunning those people who offend the group, you know, discouraging outside socialization, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's not great.
And I so there was a couple books written about like from survivors and people who like left the Exclusive Brethren. So I can read you a quote on that from a lady named Rebecca Stott.
Please, yeah.
Yeah, just to give you an idea of the type of people his father was associated with. But this is from a book called In the Days of Rain, A Daughter, A Father, A Cult. It says, quote, in this closed community, books that didn't conform to the sex rules were banned. Women were subservient to men and were made to dress modestly and cover their heads. And those who disobeyed the rules were punished and shamed. So pretty hardcore stuff.
Not great.
And I think, you know, maybe might have a later effect, an effect on some of his later views. But so I thought it was a little pertinent.
Yeah, for sure. Because he also... was sent to like a Bible school effectively,
right.
Later on, and had some clashes with the guy in charge of it because he was a naughty little boy.
He was a naughty little boy.
And I argue he stayed that for his entire life.
Absolutely.
That said, he, even though his father was, you know, wilding out a little bit in church.
Yeah.
He was quite wealthy.
Yes.
And also had a very good relationship with young Edward, soon to be Aleister.
The two of them got along. The mother...
Yeah, they got along really well. His mother he was less of a fan of.
Yeah.
Which is to say, he hated her, and she didn't exactly endear herself to him. She gave him the nickname The Beast.
Yes.
Which, pretty metal.
Probably, pretty sick.
Probably not something you should do to your children, though.
Yeah, it's gonna have an effect. Clearly.
Yeah, if you raise your child calling him the Beast, unsurprisingly, he may go on to call himself the wickedest man in the world. Basically, yep. What we're saying, official historic esoterica stance, Freud was right.
Well.
So he went on to go be educated at Cambridge, where he briefly considered careers as either a mountaineer or, and this is a funny one, I was messaging friend of the show, my twin brother, Mike K. Ultra, about this. He went to school and initially was majoring in philosophy, but then switched to English, much like myself.
Yeah.
And also was very into chess, much like my brother. So we may be like the good version of Aleister Crowley out there.
So like
around.
If you would have took Aleister Crowley and split him into two different people.
Yeah.
They would have been two good but kind of strange guys.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't do Michael like that. Sorry, Mike.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
He can take it. He's listening to this podcast. That does make you a little weird.
Yeah.
Shout out to the train going by my apartment. All right. Wild yeah. start. No, did you have anything more to say on that?
On his like early childhood? Yeah, I just want to like, so him and his dad had a good relationship, but then in 1887, his father died. And like we said, he had a good relationship with his father. And it was like soon after his death that Alistair began misbehaving in school, criticizing Christianity, smoking, and sleeping with prostitutes. And yeah, also, I think one of the quotes I said, like it read, he became like obsessed or like with masturbating or something like that. Which
yeah,
is like,
yeah, he was going a little crazy.
He was going a little wild.
He's introduced to both masturbation and prostitutes by a Bible salesman. Whose name I forgot to write down, which I don't know how you square that circle, your profession and your pastimes. But...
Was it Moses Prey from Paper Moon? Have you seen that movie?
Yes.
Just the absolute huckster. But no, yeah, but it sounded kind of to me like a little bit like a coping mechanism. And,
yeah,
you know, just to kind of humanize this guy a little bit, because we will have thoughts later. So, you know, you all right?
Yeah, you're good. Did you hear that?
No.
Okay, sorry, we can cut this out. There was just a loud laugh echoed down the hallway, and I was like, ugh. anyway, yeah, so with his father, his father's death, yeah. He inherited a third of his fortune, which in today's money comes out, I don't remember the exact number, it was about $7 million, if I remember right.
Yeah.
So a pretty penny to get at the age of 11.
Yeah. More than I was getting. 25 yeah, cents a week, you know.
he didn't come into it all immediately, of course, right. But you know, in his college days he got really into mountaineering, which he funded with his, you know, fortune. Yeah. And also self-publishing books of very bad poetry.
Yeah.
Real
bad.
Yeah, some of them were like just sort of like meant to be like either romantic or mystical. Some yeah. of them were just like, there's one called White Stains was one of the collection's names. And it's, yeah, that's what it's about. It's
ugh.
It's as crass and gross as you can imagine.
Come on, dude.
Don't read it. The poems are icky.
Yeah, that sounds icky. I don't like that.
And he also burned through his fortune pretty quickly because he insisted on printing these poems on like the finest paper and leather imaginable.
That I mean,
and sold almost no copies. So anyway, he also around this time he had his first experience with gay sex as well, because this man was, let me tell you, if you've been online and you're familiar with the idea of a disaster bisexual, oh boy.
I guess, yeah, he sure was a Crowley disaster, which is I think why ladies loved him so much.
Yeah, there had to be something. So he also, like I said, like around this time, he was going on like crazy mountaineering expeditions. He started a very one-sided beef with Oscar Wilde, which I thought was funny. I don't know if you saw anything about this.
I did. Yeah. Returning champion Oscar Wilde. Did Wilde ever like come out and like say anything to him?
I looked far and wide because could you imagine what this guy could have said about Crowley? But no, he doesn't appear to have written anything down.
Which is maybe the ultimate roast in it. Of itself.
Yeah, somehow that's much more cutting than, you know, one of his little snide remarks that he could make. But at the time, Crowley functionally accused Wilde of, like, being gay for clout, which is a very funny thing to do in England at this time, considering that it, like, ruined his life. And then from there, you know, he got into Kabbalah like every rich freak ever, which sort of escalated into an interest in, like, astral projection, which he was trained in by a guy he met while he was out mountaineering and just started like talking about alchemy in a bar. And the guy was like, oh, I'm an alchemist. Let's train you in astral projection. And then this is, I think, the moment where I want to just like do a quick sidebar. When we talk about like ritual magic and astral projection and these sorts of things, a lot of the time it's symbolic, like what he writes about it. Or in the case of things like, you know, scrying or astral projection, it's sort of like meditation and a trance state is what you're really doing, right? Where it's like, oh, I can see this other world that I'm in. It still requires an immense amount of like willpower and focus, right?
Right.
Like, If you don't
have astral projected into Hogwarts and Harry is my boyfriend.
Yeah, yeah, he was doing the TikTok thing. He was shifting.
Literally. He was shifting. That's what it's called. Yeah.
Yeah, but like, you know, while it's funny and it's easy to make fun of, like, try to sit down and then just like imagine yourself in like another room so realistically that it feels like you're there. It is a very difficult thing to do. And Crowley took to it remarkably quickly. Which from this point, because of this like talent, he was inducted into the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn by one Samuel Mathers. And this is where the occult for him really goes from just a passing interest to something he really is into. So this sidebar about Samuel Mathers, we discussed him along with Crowley at the in our first episode, our history of grimoires. British occultist, another one of these rich little freaks just running around. And he was one of the main figures in the Golden Dawn, which was it's one of those, like, there were a lot of these guys floating around. It's a paramasonic organization.
Right. Rich guys have their weird little club and get to dress up and have fun. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the rich little dandies. They dress up, they have fun. And
yeah. Quick, random sidebar about this too. Mm-hmm. Like if you look up the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, you'll see their rose cross, which is like their logo. It's like this complex clashing colors, really bad looking logo.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you remember this. Do you remember there was that shooting a little while ago at that like parade or like festival or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like that kind of scrawny kid whose like dad ran for mayor or something like mm-hmm. that. But I don't know if you remember this, but his mom, somebody uncovered his mom's Facebook and she just had like a full like maybe 10, 11 inch tall like printout of the logo of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn like on her wall in their home, in their like nice suburban home.
I did not. You don't remember? I ever heard that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm forgetting the name of the guy, but he was the one who's like posting like the videos to YouTube.
Yeah, like
and stuff.
The crazy like MKUltra looking videos.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like at first you're like, yeah, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. But once I saw the Rose Cross of the Golden Dawn like in his mom's house just on Facebook, I was like,
yeah, that is a little weird.
A little much, cuz it's quite a thing to have. But anyway, that's just a sidebar.
But yeah, so then just quick final note about the Golden Dawn, right? Yeah. They're just like the Freemasons and a lot of these other secret societies, it was divided into different like levels or orders.
Right.
So the first order was like the basic esoteric stuff, right? Like some Hermetic Kabbalah, astrology, tarot reading, your classic stuff that you get into when you're in an edgy phase in college.
Is what they call you. Yes.
And then the second order learned things like astral projection and scrying, alchemy, more advanced ritual magic. And then above them is the third order, the secret chiefs, as they were called.
Yeah.
And these were, allegedly, highly advanced magicians who were communicating with the chiefs of the Second Order. These chiefs were William Woodman, William Westcott, and Samuel Mathers.
Samuel Mathers.
So Crowley, when he joined, he was like kind of excited about it, right? He was pretty stoked because he's like, okay, now we're learning the real stuff. And then they just sort of plopped him down and dropped him in the First Order. And he pretty quickly realized, like, oh, these guys are just like a bunch of rich losers.
But yeah.
It's
an MLM for rich losers, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But because he already knew most of the stuff they were going over, though, he climbed the ranks pretty rapidly.
Yeah.
My notes are a little disorganized because of the insane way in which I was taking in information. But I did list out just a couple notable members of the Order of the Golden Dawn. Because the thing about them is, just like every other, you know, sort of weird little secret society, even if they were a bit silly, there were also a lot of powerful people involved with them. And so lots of artists and writers, right? Like there was Annie Horniman, who was known for like launching the careers of several writers, including George Bernard Shaw, Bram Stoker, author of Dracula, William Butler Yeats, who hated Crowley, just as a side note. And also Arthur Conan Doyle, which was the only one I didn't know before this. I was like, oh, what are we doing here?
Artie.
But yeah, yeah, Arthur Conan Doyle got into some weird stuff.
Yeah.
This is also the first time that he was like introduced to drugs and combined them with ritual magic. So there's a lot going on. Like I said, he was rapidly climbing the ranks and was told that he couldn't join the Second Order. he had to like wait a little bit. And there's a lot of reasons for this. One is just they didn't want to do it too quickly. Two is that pretty much everybody other than Samuel Mathers just hated Crowley and didn't want him to become even more powerful and annoying. So Crowley set about doing some rituals in the meantime, as you do, trying to summon powerful spirits in his apartment, things like that. He moved up to an estate called Bolskin by Loch Ness, which
yes,
we won't spend much time talking about that because Subliminal Jihad has a lovely episode about
they
that.
Do.
So we're going to plug them. Check out their episode on the Loch Ness Monster.
Mm-hmm. Maybe and the Loch Ness Monster was man all along, Matt.
And so strange things started happening there. Like his housekeeper like went insane and tried to kill his family. A couple other people like died under mysterious circumstances. And weird golden beetles showed up. But eventually he just sort of lost patience with his probationary period, decided he was coming back to the Golden Dawn, where he was inducted into the Second Order personally by Mathers, because there was a little bit of a dispute going on amongst the Golden Dawn, because Woodman had died, so that meant that there were two people in charge now, like two of the real head honchos. And then Westcott, I don't know if you know this story, Westcott got exposed for doing ritual magic because he lost a bunch of papers relating to his studies by leaving them in a cab, and then someone discovered them.
That's pretty
funny. And then started talking about it. And
that's funny way for that to happen.
Yeah.
I was curious, because about this time where he's inducted into the Second Order, I remember reading that he was like not particularly popular with people in it.
Yeah.
And I think, did that have something to do with his sexuality and his
honestly
libertine lifestyle, as Wikipedia kept saying?
I don't know if his sexuality had much to do with it. Like, it was okay. Definitely an aspect.
Sure.
But something that you will discover as we carry on with this is that gay sex was happening all the time with the rich people of Britain, especially like it. And so, while there were definitely some people who were sort of worried by that,
yeah.
Again, like I said, Oscar Wilde was also out like doing Crowley's stuff better. I think it is really the big problem was just that Crowley was an insane egomaniac.
Yeah.
And pretty much immediately was saying that he was going to become one of the secret chiefs. Like almost immediately after getting inducted,
he was on his Kanye vibe.
Yeah, he was on his Kanye
wave.
Also a little anti-Semitic, so really yeah, on his Kanye vibe.
But, so sad.
But anyway, so Westcott, like I said, he had to leave the order or at least stop publicly associating with them, so he wouldn't get fired from his job as a coroner, because his boss told him to stop doing spells or he would fire him.
That's so funny.
It's so funny.
Just calling your employee at your office like, God damn it, Westcott, yeah. You're doing spells.
But then, you know, people got a little, members of the Golden Dawn got a little frustrated with Mathers sort of being the only guy who was in charge, right? At this point, he's saying, I'm in touch with the secret chiefs. I know what has to happen. And so Westcott, a little later on, was able to sort of come back, which led to a bit of a power struggle. Because Mathers had lost some popularity and thought that Westcott was a fraud because he had left the order. So anyway, like I said, when Crowley came back, Westcott rejected his request to join the Second Order, but Mathers was delighted to just welcome him in anyway. Bumped him up to Second Order. So things continued to escalate and they decided to retake the Golden Dawn's headquarters, which led to some Looney Tunes level shenanigans. I won't get into it in great detail, but like
yeah.
William Butler Yeats just changed the locks on the headquarters at one point, which foiled these powerful magicians for a few days until they came back again.
It is funny to be like, I am doing sex magic to change the turning of the world. And then like stuck at a door. You're like, oh crap. Oh,
hang on now. And he also, so later on, they were able to come in, and then Crowley changed the locks on one of the rooms specifically while someone else was, like, going to get the police. And while he was in there, he, like, was doing, like, rituals to seal the room and also just wrote his name on the book that had the list of all the Second Order initiates, which is a level of childish pettiness that I honestly do kind of respect.
You kind of have to admire it, yeah.
But then once again, the police arrived and politely asked this master magician to leave, which he did. under protest.
It is just so, like, it's amazing that they're, like, somewhere in Britain at that time, like, a seven-year-old is, like, working 80-hour weeks as a chimney sweep to feed his family. And meanwhile, all the rich people are, like, doing magic and, like, pranks on each other, changing the locks.
Yeah, W.B. Yeats is pushing Aleister Crowley down the stairs as they scream curses at each other.
Yeah, it's like, wow, great, wonderful world we live in here.
So at this point, he sort of decides to pump the brakes on the Order of the Golden Dawn, which is to say he got kicked out. And he returns to mountaineering for a little bit. He does this throughout his life. He sort of bounces between different things. And he attempts to climb K2, which is the second tallest mountain in the world. He reached an altitude of 20,000 feet and set a record for, like, the longest time spent at that altitude. So, again, I really do need to stress this. He was an accomplished mountaineer. And he didn't reach the summit, but the climb is still a very impressive feat, and it wouldn't be reached for another 50 years. So I think we can cut him a little slack for not making it up there.
That's pretty impressive.
And at this point, Crowley had a falling out with Mathers, and also around now met his first wife, Rose Kelly, an unstable alcoholic, which many of his wives were. And they were married the day that they met, to help Rose get out of an arranged marriage.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he was initially, honestly, pretty unimpressed with her. If you, like, read his writings about her, he didn't seem to think that much of her. But over the course of their honeymoon, he did grow quite enamored with her. And Rose got pregnant, although she continued drinking heavily. She never stops drinking throughout this story. And Crowley, while they were honeymooning, they, like, toured Saharan Africa and Egypt, and Crowley began various rituals while they were honeymooning in Egypt, and Rose, who had no knowledge of Egyptian mythology, began acting very strange. And also, I'd like to note, a lot of these things are according to Crowley's telling of events, right? So just bear that in mind as we continue with what I'm about to say. Entering, like, a pseudo-trance state and repeating things such as "they are waiting for you" over and over, which drove Crowley up the wall. It was like driving him insane. And eventually she told him he had angered the Egyptian god Horus. Egyptian gods at this point were not, like, really well known. Like, Egypt fever hadn't exploded in Britain the way it was going to soon. It was still, it was an underground thing, right? Just the occultists were really into it. And so he asked her a series of 12 questions about Horus and Egyptian mythology, none of which she would have known the answers to, and all of which she answered correctly. And so, at this point, she had his attention.
Now, remember, this is according to the author of White Stains.
Yeah,
once again, throw that out there.
Exactly. So do bear this in mind. Take it all with a grain of salt. Much like all of Crowley's writings, some of it's going to be embellished for excitement. Some of it will just be there as a symbolic thing. And some of it's just, you know, there to shake things up and make the prose a little more exciting. But he asks her to take him to see Horus. And she led him through a museum, walking past a bunch of different lots, and he would repeatedly ask, like, "Oh, is that Horus?" And she'd go, no, that's not him. Like, trying to trip her up, and she didn't fall for it. She walked up, and from across the room, pointed over and said, "That is Horus." And he walked over and was astonished to see, A, it was correct, and B, in this museum, it was lot number 666. So, Crowley really was on what, he was like, okay, whatever Rose is on right now, we're gonna ride this train. And he received the book of,
Can I pick your brain about this?
Please. Yeah.
Cause I would like, as we go along, to just, like, offer our impressions on these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, like, what do you think about this? Like, do you think this actually happened? Do you think there was something a little weird going on here? Or do you think, like we said earlier, this is just quote unquote, according to Crowley?
I think it was probably pretty heavily symbolic, right? And I think that it definitely didn't happen exactly the way that he's telling it.
For sure.
But also, you know, when we're about to start talking about, like, the Book of the Law, right? And how he received it from Eowas. For the rest of his life, he insisted that he heard a voice telling him this thing. Like, so whether or not that's actually what happened, his insistence on it literally being a voice that revealed these things to him does make me think, I do genuinely believe that, in the very least, he believed he received this from somewhere. And, you know, later on, he like speculated that he might have just been communicating with like a repressed part of his soul or something like that.
Interesting.
And so whether it was like a delusion or a demon or anything else telling him these things, I genuinely do think that he believed what he was selling with the Book of the Law. And he took magic seriously his entire life, which is why it's kind of hard to just dismiss everything he does out of hand.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to be kind of like flippant because a lot of this is so laughable and like a lot of these personalities are just so obnoxious. It's easy to go like, oh, yeah, you guys are doing magic. Can't open a door, you know, like as they're doing earlier. But like they definitely took this seriously and there was a lot that went into this. And I'm kind of with you where I think like, yeah, there's something to this. Maybe it's psychological, you know, or maybe it's just another one of the classic djinn deceptions we've talked about so prominently here. I don't know.
You know, but hey, it's. We're not ruling anything out.
Us ruling something out? Well, don't be insane.
But yeah, and so like we alluded to, right? He at Rose's behest, or you know, whatever was talking through Rose, he received the Book of the Law from his guardian angel, as he later determined him to be, Eowas, which spoke to him as a voice over his left shoulder. Over the course of 3 days, it would start at noon and continue for 1 hour exactly and then stop. And he just recorded everything he heard from it. And this book became the Book of the Law, which is like the foundational text of Thelema, the religion that he founded later on. It's inarguably his biggest and also his, I mean, not biggest in terms of length. It's like 14 pages, if I remember right. It's very short, but in terms of its impact, it is the biggest thing. Like, if you've heard, like, do what thou wilt, or every man and woman is a star, probably his two biggest quotes, those are both in this. It's...
Yeah.
It's interesting, right? Because it's definitely moving as well. Like, you read it, and you feel something when you're reading it. Maybe not
nothing good
all the time.
And I think that's how you know maybe it wasn't truly him who penned those words because he sucked at writing. So
yeah, that's the thing, right? His prose is remarkably better in this than it is in when you're like reading his silly little rhymes about eating poop or whatever. which he did write a poem about that.
Of course he did.
And he himself actually later said that he was horrified by the Book of the Law when he first like received it, and he sort of hid it away and didn't like put it out there. And you know, like I said, that's very interesting considering that it later on became like the key text for Thelema, right?
That's very fascinating. Yeah, and again, like, you know, is he being, when he's saying like, oh, I was horrified by it, is it him being theatrical or like how much can we take him at his word? It's hard to say, obviously, but
yeah,
there is something special and maybe off about this text, I would say.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'd say I recommend reading it. I recommend at least glancing through it. Roswell is shaking his head. So we are split on this.
Don't let it into your homes, folks.
Do not let it into your homes. It's interesting. It's an interesting thing to read. If you,
like me,
have the spiritual fortitude and knowledge of the occult required.
Of course, the angels guarding over you.
And the angels guarding
over
you,
mission.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So basically what I'm saying is, if you're not on my level, don't read it. But
yeah, you're a level 2 spirit guardian or whatever.
Exactly. You join our Patreon, and then you reach the second order of Historica Esoterica.
And you get a cool t-shirt, too. So it's really a win-win. But yeah, no, there's something interesting about this. And like, again, it's incredibly influential on occultism, obviously. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in this as a historical subject, you can't just gloss over this thing.
Yeah. So from there, he has his first daughter who has the unfortunate name of, hang on, let me see if I can do this all in one breath, Nuit Ma Ahanthur Hectate Sappho Jezebel Lilith Crowley.
Jeez.
So he literally just, they named her after every single, like, famously witchy and evil woman they could think of.
Yeah.
And then also Sappho, the gay poet, which is very funny to just stick her in there. So, you know, that's the name they do. So it's good to know that, like, rich freaks have always named their children insane things.
Yeah.
By this point, his habit of self-publishing incredibly fancy manuscripts and going on long, long honeymoons to Egypt was beginning to affect his coffers a little bit. So he took a break from ritual magic and instead climbed Kanchenjunga, the third tallest mountain in the world. He was invited to join this trip and refused to join unless he was put in charge, which, you know, ever the gracious guest. And so from pretty much before they left for the mountain, he was making terrible decisions. Like, he invited a local hotel owner who had no experience with mountain climbing to come along because he owed the guy a hefty debt in terms of unpaid room fees. And he just offered to let him come along instead. He also treated quite a few of the porters pretty terribly. And this continued until a mutiny was launched on the mountain and everybody basically kicked him out and told him that they were going to keep going. He ominously warned them that they would die if they continued without him. And he was correct. The day after they left without him, an accident happened and several of the porters died. They were tied together and walking across, I think it was a cliff face. And one of them slipped and fell and pulled several others down with him. And they died.
Yeah.
And this was the first time that Crowley really caught flack in the news, because everybody blamed him for this. Understandably.
Yeah,
You know, his terrible behavior led to these guys sort of striking out on their own. And the others, there were other experienced mountaineers, but, you know, the guy in charge of the trip suddenly got kicked out. And they carried on without him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's also sort of like just indicative of his personality and kind of his quality as a fella.
Yeah. So he returned to London and started continuing what he called the Abramelin ritual, one of several rituals that he would do throughout his life. He'd started it in Scotland when all the weird stuff started happening and then put it on hold to rejoin the Golden Dawn. So he started doing it again. But again, he's getting a little low on cash, so he falls in at this point with George Bennett, a paranoid, drug-addicted nobleman who basically just takes him on vacation in Africa for a couple months where he teaches him about occultism. Around this time, he also became friends with John Fuller, a British military officer who would later become a big fan of Hitler and Nazism. So,
interesting.
Not great.
I was just going to say, isn't this around the same year where he has a second daughter?
Yes, yeah.
Who's named Lola Zaza, which is pretty much better than her older sister. Like, she got off easy.
Less evil, but we're still not doing great.
When you go outside and smell that Zaza.
But yeah, I will note, on my notes, I kept forgetting to write down years, so a lot of this is going to be just sort of like vague shapes. So, sorry, listeners. I was driving myself insane with my research, so...
It's okay.
So, let's see. But most importantly, around this time, he fell in love with, did also fall in love with this guy, but he just fell in with Victor, I don't know if it's Neutberg or Neudberg. Did you see anything about this guy?
Yeah, I did. The poet?
Yeah. Yeah, so he was a poet of not much talent or repute, but he did launch the career of Dylan Thomas, a very famous poet. So
interesting.
Yeah. Like I said, Crowley just had this weird way of just like slithering in to the lives of all these people with really big connections. Like, every time I would, like, click on a name and, like, do some research, it's like, oh, your name is blue on Wikipedia, your parents' names are blue. Like, it's just all these powerful people all hanging out together with the same interests. So, Neudberg, that's the pronunciation. I'm doubling down on my pronunciation.
Yeah, I think you're
this
right.
Time. Yeah. Neudberg was quite wealthy, and so he began bankrolling all of Crowley's exploits.
Yeah.
And he started performing rituals publicly. Like, he would allow people in to watch them, which gained him a lot of attention, right? Because these things were previously secret and all that.
Right.
And he also started publishing an occult magazine called The Equinox.
Now, are these types of rituals they're doing, are these the sex magic?
They're not sex magic, but they're still a little... They're, like, adjacent to it, though, right? Like, I read this account that a reporter wrote. I forgot to actually quote it. But he was doing like a ritual to invoke Pan, who, as we know, was experiencing something of a renaissance around this time. The witch cult hypothesis was about to get out there. So lots going on. But like they like drank peyote, and he would like read like Latin scripture, and they would wear like golden and red robes. Like, he looked like evil and scary, and it freaked out all the journalists, so he got a bunch of attention. And let's see. So with all of this newfound attention, he felt ready to publish the Book of the Law. So he put it out there, and that's when he really exploded, right? Everybody yeah. starts paying attention to this guy. And like I was saying before, right? Like, there's some, as you heard in the quote that we started at the beginning, the Book of the Law is terrifying in places. Yeah. It is very evil. And the other problem with Crowley, right, is that like a lot of Thelemites will go like, oh, well, he was just joking about that. Or like, oh, you can just sort of like separate that from like the good parts of it. But Thelema is so thoroughly a religion created by Crowley, and it's so obviously something created by Crowley, it's really difficult for me to separate Crowley from his fans from the religion he made, which I think is just something to bear in mind if you go about looking into Thelema or talking to the apologists who try to separate it from Crowley.
Yeah.
So he, once again, because he spent so much money on it, he became very, very broke once more. So Neudberg started bankrolling it all again. They ventured out into the desert and did like ritualistic sex magic, because of course they did.
Yeah.
and this was their first time that they really did sex magic as a thing, right? And later on, spoiler alert, this would seriously damage Neuberg's like mental health, right?
Because yeah, didn't he have like a nervous breakdown?
Yeah, he just had a nervous breakdown. But the thing is, right, I think both ritual magic and sex, I don't think that either of them is inherently evil, right? But they're both things that you need to but you know, they're both things that you need to engage in carefully, right? I think you can't be flippant about either of them. And Crowley, while he was very intentional about his use of both things and even his use of combining them, he never seems to pay any attention to the effect it's having on the other people involved. And that's why, like, there's just a wake of, like, lives that get ruined behind him.
Yeah.
When you look at it, like, so many people, especially later on in his life, would either, like, get institutionalized or go insane or kill themselves.
Yeah. Which, you know, I think either speaks to the type of person he was or the type of entities he was communing with, if you want to be superstitious about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think, you know, a little bit of both there, right?
Maybe a little bit of both.
And also the people who are drawn to him, right?
Like, yeah, of course.
Because I think
yeah.
it does attract a certain kind of unstable person.
For
As an unstable person, I can say, like, if your life is going well, you don't get into chaos magic, right?
No, like, I don't think you do. Yeah.
And it, as a side note, we'll make your life worse. Don't do it.
Thank you. So I did want to just do a quick aside, because while we were talking about the sex magic stuff, I just went and clicked over to the sex magic page on Wikipedia, and of course, like, the first it's part of a series on Thelema, so like it's like widely what it's associated with, but the first subheading about the earliest known practical teachings of sex magic were from Paschal Beverly Randolph, which I don't know if you remember that name, but it's on our list of things to study. It was one of our listeners
on Twitter told us to look into it. So
yeah, so we're going to have to go through that, because he was a 19th century occultist. And so that was kind of the earliest.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so we'll have to go through and study that. So stay tuned to that later on.
Yeah. So there's one final little bit of stuff that he did with Neudberg before we get to the big one, which is to say they did a ritual, also another ritual out in the desert, right, in which they summoned a demon, or were invoking a demon, right, which possessed Crowley. They used, like, the blood of several birds that they had sacrificed. And the idea was that they would fight it and then cross over into enlightenment, which, of course, they did. And they argued that this was, like, really what became a watershed moment for them in terms of, like, their power and stuff like that. But just an interesting note, this fight took place December 6th, 1909. So it was exactly 60 years before the event in which a Hell's Angel biker hired by the Rolling Stones killed a hippie at one of their concerts, which is, you know, one of the events that is said to have ended the 60s.
Right.
The Stones, of course, at the time were working with Kenneth Anger, someone who we'll get into a little later, but Anger, spoiler alert, big Thelemite. Just sort of weird, spooky coincidence.
Yeah.
So anyway, High off of this victory, Crowley returns to London, where he learns he's being sued by Mathers for breach of contract because he was performing secret rituals publicly. And initially, the ruling was a judge ruled in favor of Mathers because the judge was also a Freemason and was like offended at the idea of publicly showing these rites. But then another judge who was not a Freemason later overturned it and ruled in Crowley's favor, which I thought was just funny. But the trial was actually really good for Crowley because he had at this time founded a secret order, right? The Astrum Argentinium, yes. Or Argentium, or the Silver Star, yeah. Which was a Golden Dawn-esque organization that he was running. All these things were pretty much the same.
So now this is this a Thelemic organization or is this separate from Thelema?
It wasn't initially Thelemic. Now, I mean, well, nowadays it fell apart. Like a lot of these things, it pretty much fell apart after Crowley died. Right. Towards the end of it, though, since it was so tied in with Crowley, that's the other thing. He becomes such a part of everything he's part of that it all becomes Thelemic, whether it officially is or isn't, right?
Like, right.
He's impossible to separate. As he talks about, the will, right? That just truly that ability to just impose your will on the world, you know, for better or for worse, generally for worse. He was very good at that, and his influence really does just bleed into everything. So we're going to pick up, because I can see we're getting a little low on time here.
Yeah.
But later, the Ordo Templi Orientis, another group of, like, rich freaks and sex magicians.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the OTO, which was also founded by a bunch of, like, Germans tied to intelligence. But anyway, they would read Crowley's writing and accused him of publishing their secrets. And then when they met him, they learned that he had never actually read any of their stuff and had just come to their same conclusions. And they were so impressed by this that they just put him in charge of the British chapter of the OTO, which went on to become another big Crowley thing.
Right.
Around this time, he also traveled to Russia in 1914 while managing a musical group. And most importantly, he did the Paris working.
Wait, are you telling me a manager for a music group is connected with...
Actually satanic and
satanic?
Evil?
Satanic? Yeah, can you believe it?
But so then from there, he did the Paris working, which was in Paris, right? Ritualistic sex magics. And after 6 straight weeks of doing this, Neudberg suffered a severe nervous breakdown. Like, he spent time in a sanitarium. It was really bad. And after he got out, he withdrew from ritual magic and distanced himself from Crowley and was never the same. For the rest of his life, he was afraid of Crowley. And Crowley, for his part, clearly in his own way, deeply regretted what had happened, because Neudberg really was, they had a special pairing. He was just, Neudberg was very good at taking the abuse that Crowley would dole out.
Yeah.
And they both, in a deeply unhealthy and strange way, seemed to enjoy it. And it definitely made, all of Crowley's biggest achievements were with Neudberg at his side.
Yeah. Am I reading into this too much? Did they have a romantic relationship?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. There was so much sex involved, to be clear.
Well, I knew there was sex involved. I'm talking romance, baby.
Yeah.
Those are two different things.
Very good point. No, it was also romantic.
Okay. I was curious about that, because reading what happened to Neudberg, it just felt very much like a really bad, toxic breakup. And also, like, I feel like I read somewhere that, like, afterwards kind of Crowley would sort of like say like that Neudberg was weak and couldn't like handle it. Mm-hmm. You know, like he couldn't handle the heat, so he had to get out of the kitchen, so to speak. And like,
yeah, very much like in the way that, like, you know, especially in high school, like your worst friend would have a breakup and then just be like, she just didn't get it, man. Like,
yeah,
I think you just sucked a little bit, dude. It's okay. But very similar energy there. However, you know, the Paris working, one of the rituals was screwed up a little bit by Neudberg, of course. And later on, Crowley would blame him for World War I, saying that that working going wrong was what caused World War I to happen. So, you know, like I said, such a big ego. Yeah. Even like the worst events in the world have to be his fault, right? So he was planning another mountaineering expedition when World War I happened, which put a damper on his plans. So instead, he hopped aboard the Lusitania, just weird little note there, and traveled to New York City, which he hated. He found little success there, although he picked up a career as a ghostwriter for Evangeline Adams, a famous astrologist and fortune teller. Yeah. And later on, they would argue, it turns out he, by ghostwriter, he pretty much wrote everything she was involved in, and then she just sort of signed her name on it, which is pretty rough. There's arguments about who was most involved, but it is very funny that they didn't put that in writing so as to avoid this issue.
Yeah.
And he picked up a career working for a pro-German newspaper. Two pro-German newspapers, actually, and he would one of those moments where it's like, oh, that's pretty funny. After they bombed London, he admonished them for not getting his aunt's house and then published her home address so that they could get it right the next time.
It's
pretty funny. You gotta give him credit. That's pretty funny.
Hats off. See, this is the problem, is like, we talk about him, it's like, this guy sucks. And then he'll do something like that, and you're like, oh, he's winning me back over. Yeah. I hate it.
So later on, he would claim he was a British secret agent and was writing articles that were so outrageous that every American would actually get pushed closer to being in favor of the British by his crazy writings. He also founded the first chapter of the American OTO while he was there.
Yeah.
And just sort of bounced around the U.S. for a few more years, spreading the good word of magic.
Is this where he, this was in New York, this is where he met one of his many lovers. We've glossed over several of them, but Leah Hersig?
Yes.
I want him to take a brief dive into her, because she was interesting.
Yeah, for
sure. So, she was just a lady from like Greenwich Village in Manhattan, and they met, and she actually sought him out in 1919, because she had an interest in a cult, and I guess, you know, she was able to find him, and so she was consecrated as his Babylon, aka Scarlet Woman. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about the Scarlet Woman?
Oh, yes. That was a big Thelemic concept, right? It was pretty much just whatever woman he was in love with at the time. Yeah. But she was, this embodiment of sin and lust that he would use to sort of focus his ritual energies. Rose Kelly was the first Scarlet Woman.
Right. So it's basically, he wrote in his own religion, like, and there will be a hot lady who will help me do my magic. Like,
yeah. I did.
but yeah, so like she wrote, I thought this was an interesting quote from her diary in 1921. She said, quote, "I dedicate myself wholly to the great work. I will work for wickedness. I will kill my heart. I will be shameless before all men. I will freely prostitute my body to all creatures," end quote. And so like reading about this kind of stuff, like, I don't know. It just kind of paint a picture and give you an idea of like the types of people that are like flocking to Crowley, and like the type of effect he's having on them, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I don't know. That's not normal to like write that in your diary. Like, I will kill my heart. That was the one that really, I think, got to me, you know.
Yeah. It's just and weird. You know, I sort of jokingly a little earlier called him, like the first Reddit atheist. I think I did that on our Gilles de Rais episode as well.
You did, yeah.
But but he was. And when you look at like this sort of thing, it is him consciously at every moment trying to be just the wickedest and naughtiest man he can possibly
be. He's an edgelord.
Yeah, he's an edgelord.
And I think the people who are attracted to him are also kind of edgelords.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's going to draw a similar crowd. And Roswell, we can cut this out. We're almost an hour into recording, and we are on page 3 of 7 in my notes. Should we make this a two-parter? What do you want to do with this? All right. Hello, everybody. We had a brief council meeting.
We had a falling out. We have dissolved Historica Esoterica.
We have a falling out.
We're going to be starting two separate podcasts.
Roswell is, in fact, not connected to the Secret Chiefs like he has been telling me he is, and I was horrified by this. but we realized we've been recording for almost an hour. We're on page 3 of my 7 pages of notes.
So
we're going to make this one a two-parter. So we'll be recording the other episode sometime in the future and releasing it sometime in the future. We will see. But I want to just note one little thing. Next episodes, we're going to finish up with Crowley's life. We're going to talk about his influence, some theories about his possible connections to British intelligence, and you know, the different fans of his who have gone on to do some wild stuff. But I will leave you right now with another quote from Crowley. This one provided to us by the ever wonderful Dave McGowan, author of Programmed to Kill. Shouts out to Dave. And where did I put this? Hang on.
Now, I will say we've mentioned a lot of villains, like reoccurring villains on this podcast. Like we've got, you know, the Bushes, we've got Epstein, you've got Aleister Crowley, but we do have one reoccurring hero so far, and that is Dave McGowan.
Yeah, I'll admit. Yeah. So we were a little late starting our recording this time because Roswell got caught in traffic, but yeah. I used that time to just pull up a digital copy of Programmed to Kill, type in Control F Crowley, and then just go insane as I saw all the new connections I had missed.
Incredible. Which we will discuss next time.
Yeah, sorry, my roommates were just walking by. All right. Which we will discuss next time. I've got just a whole section of just things that I learned from Programmed to Kill. As relate to Crowley. So we'll go to that. But I'll leave you all with just another Aleister Crowley quote that he hits us with, that carries with it a sort of ominous resonance when we think about, you know, some of the people he influenced, which is to say, "For the highest spiritual working, one must accordingly choose that victim which contains the greatest and purest force. A male child of perfect innocence and high intelligence is the most satisfactory and suitable victim." So that's him from Magic in Theory and Practice, one of his most influential works. And just like the Satanic Bible, right? It was just written as a joke. He just wrote it to be edgy.
Yeah, right.
But not all of his followers took it that way.
Of course.
As a side note, that quote introduces McGowan's writings on the Lindbergh baby kidnapping.
Dang.
Yeah, so he really
rocks.
He comes in swinging every time.
Good Lord. And he never misses, I gotta say.
Never misses. So we will see you all soon.
Yeah. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening. Sorry that we, sorry for giving you extra content, I guess.
Yeah, sorry, you little worms. Take it, enjoy it. I'm sorry, I don't know. Apologies, I've been reading too much Crowley.
Yeah.
But no, like, thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed it, please make sure to rate us if you haven't already on either Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It would help or something, I don't know. But that would be nice if you did that. Or you could also follow us on Instagram at Historica Esoterica. Or Twitter at Hist Esoteric.
You can also like us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page now.
That's right.
So if you want to introduce the podcast to your mom and her friends,
yes,
share it with her on Facebook. Get her into it.
It's time to start radicalizing these moms. is it just facebook.com/historicaesoterica?
Yeah, just Historic Esoterica. It is a Facebook page. I posted it to our Instagram recently, but I think that link is down now. So we'll look into it. Anyway.
Yeah, sweet. Until next time, dear listeners. Whoa, 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 it's magic. You know.
Deep mouth from their throne, deep seated, the choir of the eons declare the last of the demons defeated. The man is the lord of the air. Arise, O man, in thy strength, the kingdom is thine to inherit, till the high gods witness at length that man is the lord of his spirit.